course. So let's warm up a little bit. I'd like to begin by saying I've done a little bit of research on you and your bloodlines. They carry white Irish, Barbadian convict, Afghani immigrant, and Aboriginal heritage, which sounds to me like you are the quintessential story of this land. How do you reconcile all these identities, and which one of them, if any, plays a more significant role in your artistic expression, your poetries, and your stories?
Well, I suppose, to be honest, growing up, I've never had a conflicted sense of my identity. And that's partly, I think, because that my identity is really linked to being in family. So when I think of my identity, I've always thought of my place in my family, my extended family, and my lineage. So it wasn't until, I suppose, more recent years that people, I suppose, ask or require us to choose or to decide to be one thing or another. So I really felt that growing up, I was just part of a really important, very mixed family. So that, in my family, not only do we have different so-called identities ethnically, but we have strong Muslim family members, strong Christian family members, so we had all sorts of mixes. I suppose that what my writing is dominated by it is certainly issues to do with my Aboriginal sense of self, which is very central to me, have been important in my writing. But I think more generally, and when you think about those mixes of people in my genealogy, my writing is really to try and deal with issues of inequality and injustice, so that whether I be thinking of the abuses of Aboriginal people in my family, or whether I be thinking of the abuses of someone like I'm a direct descendant of a man, Prince Moody, who was enslaved in Van Diemen's Land, shipped here from Barbados in the 1850s. And I feel a very strong connection to a person who, was forced to move halfway around the world and leave a family in Barbados and then was enslaved in Australia for 14 years. So that connection is very important. But to be honest, growing up, and I think this is the case for a lot of Aboriginal people who grew up in the inner cities of Australia, is that I'm also very strongly attached to the notion of class, which a lot of people, sort of forget about in Australia. So I grew up working class, and working class for Aboriginal people, for poorer white people, there are a lot of affinities there, which I think people have lost the sense of. So that I'm very interested in the notion of, in a country like Australia, which claims to be, an equitable country, it's not, clearly. And one of the inequities is about the difference between people who have money and people who don't have money. And the people who don't have money are people in my family, whether they came here from the Punjab, as one of my family members did, or from Barbados, or from as convicts. They've always been marginalized people. So they're the people I write about.
So this book, you write about the ties and the relationships between Aboriginal women and their daughters and their granddaughters and their friends. And you brilliantly juxtapose the softness, the softness and the tenderness and the love between mother-daughter and between grandmother and daughter. You juxtapose that so beautifully against the hatred and the racism in Australia's colonial past, with Sergeant Law and the way the system, feels the act and taking custody and thinking that they're protecting families when they're tearing them apart. But how do you do that? First of all, why did you choose to write through the lens of women? And how do you do your research to find Odette's voice inside of you, the voice of the grandmother caring for her granddaughter? I could believe that it was Odette. It was a woman grandmother talking. How were you able to achieve that?
Well, you've never met my grandmother. I think, firstly, the reason I chose to focus on women is that I had done research, in fact, so I worked as a historian. I did a PhD in history and taught Aboriginal history at Melbourne University. And one of my main research projects was to look at the way that Aboriginal women had been, you know, the really strong grassroots activists in Australia for all of the 20th century, or a lot of the 20th century. And part of their political campaigning was around letters, was around writing. So I'd done a lot of research on Aboriginal women's writing. So the sorts of things that they were demanding, you know, caring for their children, not having their children stolen from them, et cetera, I knew that. But more importantly, I think that one is I wanted to focus on women because I see women in my life, and particularly older women, as being really heroic and very courageous and leading our families and communities. Mm-hmm. Two is that you're exactly right that in choosing to have women as the central characters of the book, I then had to make a decision about their relationship to colonial violence. Mm-hmm. And I made a decision well before I started the novel that although, you know, the violence is on the periphery of this novel all the time, we know the history that these women are dealing with, and we know the potential for violence is ever present in Odette and Sissy's life. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want it to really penetrate in the sense that I wanted the novel to be a novel about love and tenderness, and in a really tactile physical way as much as a spiritual way. So, you know, everyone has talked about the what are called the bath scenes in the novel, and I wanted to convey the beauty and touch between Odette and Sissy. And really, to be honest, that is drawing on, yeah, I didn't find it hard to write with women and girls as the central characters because I was drawing on my own history and experience of being surrounded by women in my life. So, yeah, my grandmother and my mother, aunties, my sisters, and I have four daughters and they're adults now. And all of the ways that they express love is ways that I've experienced. And it doesn't have to be, by the way, through women. So today, each week I take care of one of my grandchildren, and today it was my grandson Archie, who's two, and you know it's the same. He loves to rub my back when I'm hugging him. So I was just carrying him he fell over, and I picked him up, and I was taking him to the other room, and I was holding him, and he just involuntarily almost just starts rubbing your back. So I love that, and I suppose learning that from women, it's also something for me is important as a man, so that so that my love for my grandchildren is physical, yeah, as well. And so it's about how I think physical touch really matters. And as we find out in the novel, it matters to women such as another character, Wanda, who doesn't experience the touch of women in her life, you know,
yeah,
hugging,
yeah,
and caressing. Yeah. And it really almost destroys her. One of the issues that I would say to my work is that all of my writing, and yeah, the word is often discussed as political in the sense that all of my writing deals with the issues of oppression in different ways, and in a way that really I want to express to readers that the people on the margins of society need to be central. We need to put a focus, a lens on people who we ignore and look at their lives in a more enriched way, so that I'm really interested in the people that we ignore. And when I say we, even as Aboriginal people, we can ignore people outside our communities that are equally desperate. So I'm interested in, my sense of this is, if any person is going to act with injustice against another person, you must do it with a full knowledge of who that person is. And it's why the notion of silence and a form of censorship is ever present in Australia. Now, I think our viewers will know this, that one of the things that has happened in Australia with the terrible violence against refugees and asylum seekers is to try to make these people invisible, to put them in places where we can't contact them. Mm-hmm. There's been real attempts to not see the faces of these people, to not know the names of these people, to not hear the words of these people, to not know their stories. And my view is, if you're going to imprison a person and you're going to torture them and treat them in such as an inhuman way, you need to look at that person in the face directly and know who they are, and then can you still act? And I think, yeah, we have allowed these horrible actions to occur in this country by making people invisible. So my view of issues of solidarity are that if we focus on people who require justice, I hope and think that more of us will realise that what happens to people like Aboriginal people, like refugees and asylum seekers, like people from your own community, your own nation, I think people will be moved to not act or to act in a way of solidarity. And I suppose then to say instances of that, I think that what I try to say to young people, and I'm not going down the track of getting into a heavy discussion on, you know, so-called identity politics, but we now have, I think, you know, in the Western world, there's been a move to, I think, sometimes quite segmented identities. And I think some of those are empowering. So we know that in communities that have really come to the fore and demanding of you know, Western society that people be recognised, I understand that. But in the end, if we're going to tackle the really major issues front us, we need to build solidarity and networks across those communities and act together. So, you know, I saw your lovely photos at the Invasion Day rally, and you know, to see other people than Aboriginal people on those days is absolutely vital to us to know that things are moving. You know, think there is an energy there. And likewise, of course, you know, in regard to thinking of issues like refugees and people seeking sanctuary, people seeking support. It's one of the major issues that I've been involved in recent years. So, to put it just directly, as an Aboriginal person, if there are crimes committed against other communities on Aboriginal land, I need to take responsibility for that. And a lot of Aboriginal people think that way. When we see what's happening to other communities on our land, we see that as an injustice that we have to speak out about. For people who haven't read the book, the only thing we'll say briefly, it's a book about primarily the relationship between Odette Brown and her granddaughter Sissy, and it's about Odette's fight and struggle to protect her granddaughter, who is under threat of removal from her grandmother by a policeman, a new policeman who comes into the town of Dean, a man called Sergeant Lowe. And more widely, the book is about the attacks on Aboriginal people and the attempts to steal children from their family during this terrible period of post-war Australia, when so many thousands of children were removed. I'm just going to read a short scene that I've never read aloud before, and it's a scene where Odette meets another Aboriginal woman, Dolores, and Dolores talks about the experience of losing her own children. And the reason why I've chosen this is that while, as I said, that essentially this is a book about love and tenderness, I've decided to read this scene because I also want to make the point for our listeners and readers that these crimes are terrible crimes, and they had a devastating effect on the women and men who were affected by them. So it's a very straightforward scene where Dolores is telling Odette what happened to her children, two daughters. "The first time the welfare lady set eyes on my babies," Dolores said, "I knew I had no hope of keeping them." She took one hand away from the edge of the table and slammed it against her chest, alarming Odette. "From that day on, that bitch followed us around like a bloodhound. My eldest girl, Colleen, she was the first to go. We'd put her in the local school, a Catholic school. My husband thought it might work in our favour, putting on the God Act. He was in the Merchant Navy. He'd been away at sea 6 weeks, and then his pay stopped coming to me from the company. I never knew it at the time, but he jumped ship and took off with one of the girls. I haven't laid eyes on him since." Dolores took a worn handkerchief out of the sleeve of her cardigan and wiped her nose. "I ran out of money in no time. No sooner was I spotted in the line outside the house of charity that Colleen was taken. They picked her up from school." "Did you fight it?" Odette asked. "Fight? There was nothing I could do." Dolores put her fist into her mouth and bit down on a knuckle to stop herself from sobbing. "You know what the nun at the school said when I fronted her? Do you want to know what she said?" Odette shook her head. "She said, this is best for you. We're doing this to help you as much as help your daughter. I wanted to spit in that woman's face. I went straight home and pulled a case out of the cupboard. I poked some air holes in it with a screwdriver and put my baby girl Iris in that case with her clothes. Dolores took a deep breath and then we took off. Odette wasn't certain what she'd just been told. Did you say you put your daughter in a suitcase? Dolores wiped her nose and laughed hysterically. I sure did. That was my plan. She laughed again. It didn't work out though. We only got as far as the bus station. I was ready to jump on any bus that would get us out of the city. I didn't care where it was heading. And then bang, the case sprung open and poor little Iris, she fell out. Dolores looked down as if the child was on the floor at her feet. She stood up and began circling the table. Odette wanted her to stop, both her manic pacing and the story, which she didn't want to hear, but Dolores couldn't stop. I mean, it was funny, really funny, she cried. We both laughed. My beautiful baby girl, she was giggling, and I thought I was going to wet my pants. Dolores walked over to the back door and looked outside, concerned she was being overheard. I hadn't noticed that there was a copper right there. He'd been a couple of footsteps behind us the whole time, writing a ticket for some fellow who'd parked his car illegally. The copper saw what happened, and I knew we were in trouble. I knew it. But I couldn't stop laughing. Everyone waiting for the buses, they all thought I'd gone mad. After Iris was taken away, I was put into one of those hospitals, you know, for sick people. And by then, I was mad.